Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my brothers in arms, there's Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Howdy.
And Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Wait, is this our first time recording this episode?
For all of you, yes. However, I have recorded this exact same episode with variations of a kind 106 times.
I just wanted to check.
As Danny's terribly unfunny joke may clue you in, today we'll be talking about Edge of Tomorrow, the sci-fi action film starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, directed by Doug Liman, who is responsible for such films as Swingers, Go, and The Bourne Identity. Those are really the only ones worth talking about, right? Does anyone have any opinion on other films? Anyone see Jumper?
I've seen Jumper.
What did you think of Jumper?
I think I liked it at the time, but I was also, you know, like 14 or 15, so...
You don't count. Give yourself that out.
Yeah.
All right. So that's what we'll be talking about today. We don't have a discussion topic. I mean, there's finally a director for Ant-Man. It's the guy who directed Down with Love, so not quite Edgar Wright. Even though I enjoyed Down with Love for what it was. Not so certain about Yes Man. But and then Lupita Nyong'o has actually been cast in Star Wars. So anyone who was concerned about racial and gender diversity in that movie has just been undercut a little bit. Though anyone who was worried about Lupita Nyong'o's really promising drama career being undercut by a shitty sci-fi movie. I mean, most people got out of the prequels unscathed, so let's just cross our fingers for that one. So yeah, that's it. That's all. That's our discussion of those topics. If you would like, you can find us on iTunes, subscribe, give us a comment and a rating. We always love that. You can also comment on the page that this will be posted on The Film Stage. And you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. But without further ado, let's get into our review of Edge of Tomorrow.
I'm going to tell you a story. At first, it's going to sound ridiculous. But the longer I talk...
We have to find the keys.
The more rational it's going to appear.
I can't believe you found coffee.
Sugar, right?
Yeah.
Hold on. Three. You like three.
How many times have we been here? How many times?
For me, it's been an eternity.
So Edge of Tomorrow is a film that takes place in an unspecified time in the future when the European continent has been infested and invaded and almost thoroughly conquered by a race of black tentacled aliens called the Mimics. Tom Cruise plays against type for the first part of this film. He is a PR flack for the military who is conscripted to go onto the front lines after pissing off a general. And during his failed invasion attempt, he is doused with alien blood and gets the ability to reset the day each time that he dies, giving us a clue as to the alien's previous record, just impossibly fast and bloody conquering of the European continent, as well as a way to defeat them. Emily Blunt co-stars as a woman who may have gone through the same thing herself and is the only person who can help Tom Cruise become the hero that he needs to be to save the world. Edge of Tomorrow. In theaters now, let's see what we thought about it. Nick Newman, what was your anticipation for this film? And what did you think of it?
Well, it is from the director Doug Liman, who has never really meant much as a name. Mm-hmm. When I hear Doug Liman, I don't know if I have negative expectations, but I think to myself, this might not really be anything special. And yet I do enjoy Tom Cruise. I do enjoy Emily Blunt. And I like the concepts just sort of on its own. I mean, you know, a movie I quite liked from a few years ago was Source Code, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, directed by Duncan Jones.
Yes, that's good.
I feel like science fiction slash sort of disaster, race against time films really kind of benefit from using this conceit. So with that in mind, I went into it, you know, thinking, okay, maybe this will be fun. And as it turns out, it was basically fun. what's weird about this movie is that...
I was waiting for the awesome reversal where you said it was either amazing or terrible.
What's odd about this movie is that it kind of... is that when I think back on it, I guess I like it more than maybe I should. Or when I think back on it, I'm sort of eliding the negative aspects. Or maybe it's because I like the idea so much and I sort of like the trajectory that it takes for about 90 minutes. That, A, the sort of turgid final 20 minutes when the words reshoot should be flashing on the screen just to let you know exactly what you're watching. And also... sort of the, I think, kind of the uninspired, sort of the uninspired filmmaking on display here, where, with a few exceptions, with a few notable exceptions, granted, I feel like Doug Liman's work here is weirdly unmotivated. One such example, this is going to be very nitpicky, but I feel like I have to bring up a weird example to justify my argument here. You know, there's a scene where he's in, Tom Cruise's character's in an office occupied by Brendan Gleeson's character. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, the camera swirls around the back of Brendan Gleeson's head and it pushes in on Tom Cruise's face. But there's kind of no reason for the camera to do that. It sort of feels as if Liman just thought it would be an interesting shot to keep people's attention, which, okay, many great filmmakers have done that. I mean, let's not forget that Orson Welles put a squawking bird as a transition in Citizen Kane because he thought the film was getting a bit slow at that point. Okay. But it's one such example in the movie where I feel like Liman, as a filmmaker, I feel like his flow of images is a little plasticky. It's a little stagnant. There doesn't really seem to be much momentum behind the progression of a scene. It kind of feels like he shoots an actor saying something and then kind of goes to the next actor saying something. And occasionally he'll throw in this flourish, but it feels very out of place. I think the battle sequences in the film are decent, but they're also, perhaps intentionally, they're kind of cloudy. They're a bit, it's a bit difficult to figure out exactly what you're seeing. I mean, even the creatures, it sort of feels as if they were perhaps saving money on the visual effects because the creatures are often moving through sand and they're moving very quickly, so they kind of become these blandly colored blobs. And the effect is decent, but it kind of... I don't know. There's something about the action sequences of the movie that feel a bit almost workmanlike. And there are exceptions. I think there's a scene with a helicopter that's interesting, and I kind of sort of like the final battle, in particular, sort of the way that effect is pulled off. But as a whole, I guess Edge of Tomorrow leaves me feeling as if I kind of wanted to see someone else direct this, or maybe I would have liked to have seen the final third of the screenplay worked on and then see someone else direct this. a lot else in the movie works. I mean, I think the cast is quite good in addition to Cruise and Blunt. Bill Paxton is a lot of fun, and Noah Taylor gets a bit of work. Even though sort of the mechanics behind his character's appearance doesn't really make much sense, the way he, it almost feels as if he too is reliving the same day, kind of the way he is utilizing information, the way Emily Blunt's character is utilizing information. It's not really completely logical the way she gets caught up with things so quickly. The way that, you know, when you kind of, the movie takes time to show you this progression, and it seems as if maybe 30 minutes has gone by, but for her to understand everything that has occurred over what you get the sense to be a span of a few months, it seems like it would take a bit more time. And granted, okay, that's not really the most illogical thing in this film, but I feel like the movie sometimes sort of forgets the placement of its characters in favor of advancing the protagonist. So although I'm coming out sounding more negative, I did have a decent amount of fun. I think this has a lot of intrigue in its early moments when you kind of see the repeating day playing out and sort of the different ways that it becomes a factor in the character's behavior. And there's a stretch in the middle that I think is also quite good. So mixed positive. I would say that if you're interested in seeing it, if you're interested in seeing it, and if a matinee is available, you could do worse things with your time in a theater, especially in a summer that seems like it's going to be this dire. That this might end up being one of the better titles is kind of unfortunate, but it's, you know, the film does an okay job by itself.
And Danny King, what did you think?
Yeah, well, I also had fun with the movie, although similarly, I wouldn't kind of work to overpraise it. In terms of my expectations, it took me like five viewings of the trailer to finally figure out it was like a Groundhog Day type structure. I remember when I first saw the trailer. Yeah, I remember I first saw the trailer and I'm like, okay, like I just don't know what happened. So after a few more viewings, I was at least happy just to understand what the movie was about. But the only things that really surprised me based on what I was expecting going in was the fact that Cruise's character was this kind of like press jockey and not like an experienced warrior. And I really liked that kind of reversal of expectations, because that first scene between him and Brandon Gleeson is like a really perfect setup for that character. And it's actually kind of, it's a more complex role than you would sort of expect for a movie like this, to just introduce us to such a kind of such a pathetic character. And I really liked that. And the other thing that threw me off a little bit was just like the D-Day imagery and the fact that it was released on.
Yeah, it was released on D-Day.
Yeah. And so like that didn't, it's weird how that didn't register for me going in, because obviously, you know, over the past couple of days I've been reading stuff about the D-Day anniversary, and I have seen that trailer like five times, so I don't really know why that didn't register for me until I saw the film. But when it did, it just kind of threw me off and I found it sort of odd. But overall, I just think the movie has a clever concept and it kind of follows through on it. I would agree with Nick that the craft of the movie isn't necessarily something to talk about too much. I was a little surprised to learn that Dion Beebe was the cinematographer. He shot Collateral, which is a really gorgeous film, and this didn't look as good to me. I don't know if that's because...
Doesn't have that man digital, baby.
Yeah, it doesn't have the man digital. And I mean, the palette...
Not like City Nights either, you know?
Yeah, and the palette is just sort of a lot of grays and like a lot of dust, so I don't know, it might have just been a tough film to photograph. But I would say the best craft thing in the movie is the editing. Because all of the hard cuts from when Cruise kind of dies to when he wakes up, each one of those works. And there's a lot of good cutting for humor. The only thing that was weird about my experience with the movie is it almost went beyond the fact that it was like nodding to Groundhog Day, to the point where it just like stole that idea. And I know this is like based on a graphic novel. So
I think it's based on a novel that was turned into a graphic novel.
Okay. Cause I've read a few reviews that says based on a novel, and then a few that said it was based on a graphic novel. So I have no idea. But it's possible that the graphic novel or the novel is guilty, but it's just weird to me that almost all of the humor in this movie and everything I found clever about it is just an organic outgrowth of that premise. Mm-hmm. So I don't really, it's weird to like give the movie credit for that, because it's just stealing from another movie. This is kind of, it's something that was on my mind because I recently saw the new Kelly Reichardt film Night Moves.
Which also rips off Groundhog Day.
That too. That was shockingly unexpected.
But only because a groundhog plays a major character who is a getaway driver.
Yeah. So now more people are going to see Night Moves.
They're going to be so confused.
But obviously, you know, I've known since the title was first announced that Reichert was cribbing this Arthur Penn film, But and she recently had an interview in Filmmaker magazine where she kind of explained why she stole the title, and it was sort of like a half-baked explanation. And then there was kind of a conversation on Twitter about, like, is that Penn film just too well known to borrow the title of? And I kind of agree with that. Like,
better known than the Bob Seger song?
Yes. Yes. It's just sort of like, come up with your own title. And with Edge of Tomorrow, I just sort of had a similar reaction where it's like, okay, this is funny because Tom Cruise, you know, just lived this and now he's playing it strategically different because of his knowledge. Like, I guess good job for watching Groundhog Day and finding it funny and applying it to a new setting. But anyway, I don't know if you guys were bothered by it that much, or
I will. I'll begin my rundown of my feelings by addressing that point. Yeah, it takes Groundhog Day's premise and runs with it. And it does a lot of the things that are enjoyable about it are things that were enjoyable in Groundhog Day. For instance, being in a situation and then realizing that this is a situation that he has been in again and again. There's a scene where he's accosted by two of his squad mates the night before the invasion, and he kind of uses his knowledge of the way that this guy's going to try to hit him to get the better of them. On top of just some scenes where it's played for, like, actual interpersonal beats. I mean, yeah, that happened in Groundhog Day. But, I mean, that you can't really do anything new with the idea of living the same day over and over again in that way. The thing that I did like was that in Groundhog Day, Bill Murray's character is trapped, and even if he goes to sleep and everything is fine, the day still resets itself.
Mm.
Whereas in this movie, that's not the case.
Yeah.
So if he fails, it's either suicide or, like, death that has to bring him back and reset. So it's almost like I really wanted to get away from what everyone else has been saying, which is the video game reference.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's just nothing else in life where you kill yourself in order to do something better the next time. So, yeah, it's like a video game where if you fuck up and you realize that you're not going to make it through the level, you pop a grenade and stand on top of it. So and the fact that he still has some sense of self-preservation, but Emily Blunt, who is really, really good in her role as Rita, another Groundhog Day call-out.
Oh, wow.
Did you not pick up
Jesus.
On that?
Jesus. No, not yet.
But, yeah, the fact that she's just so unsympathetic, because she's not had to live all these days over and over again. So, yeah, like, just seeing her and her kind of cavalier attitude about it. I mean, there's in the trailer, you see the one where she's like, your leg is broken, we should start over, and he's like, oh, okay. And then the way that his response to that and how it becomes a part of their relationship is pretty incredible. I enjoyed that. And there's a mechanic that is also in place that makes it like a necessity that if he's wounded, he should kill himself as soon as possible. That adds some interesting tension to scenes where you're worried that he might survive. So I feel like, yeah, it steals from Groundhog Day. But I think the application of it to a wartime scenario and the way that the mechanic works as kind of like having a reset button you have to push instead of one that's forced on you gives it more of a sense of futility in a hilarious way, because literally every day wakes up with him screaming because he was just being murdered a split second ago. So I liked that. In general, I liked the movie a lot, more than I was expecting to. What I wasn't expecting really was this humor that the movie has. The movie is very winking in its use of this time mechanic. I do think that the final third of the film reeks of rewrites of a kind. I don't mind that so much for the final action set piece, but the way that the movie ultimately resolves itself leaves me a little, I feel a little dirty. Like, I feel a little icky. It's as though, I don't know, I just feel like something that was really cool was elementally screwed with, and someone thought that that's what I wanted, And so the fact that I enjoyed it makes me feel dirty. I much would have rather something else happened at the end, but I can't deny that as stupid as the final 2 minutes are, I liked it. So that sucks. Because there's the critical part of me that's like, it should be something else. And then there's the movie watcher part of me who went and saw a Tom Cruise film and was just like, yeah.
Great movie.
I was wondering other things during this movie. And I mean, like, it's impossible for them to take the time out to explain this. But like, well, actually, I'll get into those in spoilers. They have to do with the time mechanics. I do like that Noah Taylor's in this, though his part is very strange in exactly what Nick says. Like, he's the only person who hasn't traveled through time repeatedly who responds to the news without skepticism. So I don't know how Emily Blunt convinced him the first time, and then I don't know how Tom Cruise keeps convincing him this time.
I mean, it's not, for me, the problem isn't the
skepticism. I was just going to say, and then there, I was thinking every time Tom Cruise goes back, he's accruing more mental baggage that he has to bring forward. And so it's not just like he has to fill them in on one day. It is that he has to fill them on like 6 months of information. And it just seems to move a little too quickly. You really do get the sense that he and Emily Blunt are both unmoored from time as well. And, you know, I get it. It would be a drag if the movie had to stop and show us every time Tom Cruise went down there and, you know, completely, you know, was like, okay, we've already been through this, but you don't know, so I can't just say that we have because you still don't have the context. Oh, man, that would be tiring. So I get it, but it does make the movie feel a little buoyant in a like, speaking of gravitas kind of way. And he has a plot device mechanic, which is 100% just one of those things that again, feels like a rewrite. Because it's introduced, and then it's not brought up until it's introduced again in a way that's gonna, like, change the game. But, like, if that was a possibility, why... I don't know. I try not to think about it too much because I enjoyed the film so much. And I know that that's being kind of uncritical, but the movie does enough right that I don't feel the need to nitpick some of these things just because they didn't bother me during the film and they don't affect the enjoyment that I had of the parts that I liked. I will also say that the end credits song was perhaps the poorest soundtrack choice they could have made. Other than that, though, I like the movie. I'm always a fan of watching Tom Cruise do his Tom Cruise thing. In this film, he has, like, I would say a good 6 Tom Cruise-isms. And if that's what you're looking for in a movie, you found it. I also loved Emily Blunt. Bill Paxton was great as the Master Sergeant who has this weird spiritual streak and gives this long rehearsed monologue about, like, the cleansing, purifying fires of battle that is funnier the more that he does it, because I really got the idea that even if the same day weren't repeating over and over again, that this is probably a speech that this guy has given over and over and over again. But yeah, a fun, funny, well executed, though unremarkably directed. I mean, I don't really have a thing against Doug Liman, but I don't get Doug Liman.
I don't really have a thing against him either. I mean, I don't go, ah, oh, fucking Doug Liman. God.
He's not like Bryan Singer to you.
No.
Yeah, I mean, like, the thing is, I feel like every time he makes a movie, it gets in the news because, like, there's not an ending, and it goes over budget, and. Like, wasn't that the same problem with Mr. and Mrs. Smith? And probably The Bourne Identity?
Yeah.
Oh, well. But yeah, no, this is a fun film. I would recommend anyone to go and check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I got no beef here. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Not as good as, like, Captain America, The Winter Soldier, or Godzilla, but I would have to say that the summer so far has been surprisingly strong for films like this. Full stop.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Didn't you find it funny how Doug Liman uses the repeating structure to get that pervy shot of Emily Blunt three times.
Yeah, so weird.
The weird, like, she's doing some kind of yoga.
Right.
And then pushing up and arching her back thing.
I certainly enjoyed it. I just...
No one's complaining about it, but...
It was just kind of...
And in a movie that's refreshingly devoid of, like, any kind of female objectification, that sticks out even more.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I definitely... One of my problems with the film is when they develop some sort of romantic bond, it feels kind of... First of all, it's kind of weird because Tom Cruise is noticeably older than Emily Blunt. And it's sort of that classic thing that a lot of people have been discussing lately, which is the creepy age imbalance in a lot of on-screen romances nowadays.
Yes, man. Jim Carrey and Zooey Deschanel.
Oh, God.
That was awkward for me. I didn't like it.
Sure. but also, sort of the... You know, the movie having a happy ending, right, I mean, okay, it's a big summer movie. I guess it has to have some happy ending, but it sort of, there's this weird feeling for me that there isn't, like,
yeah, actually, I wanted to talk about that in the spoiler section, because that's, it was really, I'm not sure what the movie's doing there.
But also, I mean, I guess the movie doesn't really explain it, but I guess he is not being...
Well, we can talk about it in spoilers.
But
spoilers, Nick.
Okay.
Okay.
But yeah, the final moments of the movie are kind of... I mean, you end on a...
Oh my God! Seriously, spoilers! Oh,
is that a spoiler?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. All right, then cut it out.
Yeah, the whole... Come on, dude.
All right, cut it out.
Do you want to talk about spoilers now?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Danny, do you have anything to say before we get into spoilers?
You know, pretty fun movie. I liked the. I like the shot of him jumping off the helicopter the first time.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, and you know, then...
The one thing that I... This isn't a spoiler. Like, the one thing that I had an issue with, I guess, was the alien design. Because from the...
Oh, that's the one issue with this movie, right? The alien design.
I would say that it's my biggest kind of letdown. Because in the trailers, it makes them seem like they're these kind of Lovecraftian blobs of tentacles. And I pictured, like, a central pivot point with numerous tentacles. So kind of like a malevolent two-sided octopus. But they're really kind of more like wolves with dreadlocks. I don't know how I feel about that. I would have liked a little more alien in my alien. You know what I mean? Like, give me something we haven't seen before.
They should have hired you.
They should. You know, if people would just hire me as a concept artist, and then... If I could have a partner who could translate my stick figure drawings into a real drawing, every movie would be better. Unfortunately, no such luck.
Oh, yeah, and then that first time that he dies was pretty violent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, holy shit.
That was
Hope
the
we
other
don't
thing.
Have to see that again.
I was about to say, like, they have to make a point of not showing him dying because there's a horrific... undercurrent to this film, and the way that these aliens kill people, which is basically that they seem to strike them and then tear them limb from limb. And wow. So like that's why I agreed with you, Danny, when you said the editing was key, because you have to strike this balance where it's like, oh no, he's gonna die, and then he wakes up and it's funny instead of fucking horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Which also, I think, is what makes Emily Blunt's, like, nonchalance about capping him every time that he's injured.
Yeah, that was a highlight.
Yeah. Okay, but now, so, Nick was continuously trying to talk about the end of the movie, even as I said, let's save it for spoilers. So let's actually get into spoilers, so Nick can talk about the end of the movie. So spoilers for Edge of Tomorrow, out in theaters now. Nick Newman, what were you going to say about the end?
So there's this weird sense of, even though the character has clearly learned his lesson, and although he's saved the day and so on and so forth, the typical sort of ending there, I don't know. It feels kind of cheap that he would, in his final moments, be doused with the alien blood again and then brought back. But a little bit further, or rather to what seems like maybe an alternate timeline, perhaps, where... they do discover this. That seems to be what's going on, because they discover the thing in the Louvre.
Right.
and then they destroy it. So there's some kind of alternate timeline, I guess.
Right. So I guess, first of all, why would anyone ever listen to the spoiler section of a podcast without having seen the movie? But on the odd chance that you haven't, this is what happens. So there's like three tiers of these aliens. There's the drone fighter ones. Then like one in every 6.5 million is what they call an alpha, which are these blue-blooded motherfuckers who, when they die, reset time. So that's why Tom Cruise, every time he dies, resets time, because he has their blood in his blood now. And then there's the Omega, which is like the hive mind center base creature. And so they find out that this creature is in the Louvre by sticking something in Tom Cruise's leg that lets him have a vision of it. And then they blow it up with grenades. Emily Blunt is killed in this, and so is Tom Cruise. But then the blood of the Omega gets on him, and suddenly he's back to the beginning of the movie, which is like maybe 6 hours before he's been resetting to previously. Okay, go, Nick Newman.
Okay, so there's... I mean, I guess I don't want everything in the film to be explained to me, but there is the question of what exactly has brought him back and why he's brought back to an alternate... Was it because he was nice? Is it because he, you know, was a good guy, ultimately, who did what he could to save the day? So some weird cosmic force says, just live. Go. Do, you know, go form a new relationship with this girl and so on and so forth. It doesn't really... Again, I don't think it's that it doesn't make sense. It doesn't really need to make total sense because this is, you know, a silly concept to begin with. But the movie just doesn't really take time to explain it. And again, what I said about reshoots, it not only feels like a reshoot, it feels like something that was maybe rushed along in reshoot. They just kind of had to get it done and assume that audiences will go with it.
Right. I have a theory.
Oh.
Because I did spend more time thinking about this than I promised myself I would.
But also, there's kind of the sense of a cop-out because you know, it's just, it would have been interesting to actually have him finally die. Both of them die, but they die heroically. They do so, saving the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then, I mean, you know, the movie ends with Tom Cruise giving his Tom Cruise smile and everybody
and his, like, little half-laugh.
Likes that. Yeah, and you know, that's nice. I mean, I like that, but I feel like the movie
after
had
they've
that
gotten that pretty shot of Emily Blunt once.
Yeah, for the third time, yes. That's why they actually had this ending, so I could get that shot for the third time. But otherwise...
Everything's better in threes.
Yes, but otherwise, there's really kind of no clear motivation for why it concludes this way. It just sort of happens, and
because it's a Tom Cruise movie and he can't die. Even when he died in Oblivion, spoilers for Oblivion, there were like 78 other of him. You know, did we all see Oblivion?
That film was shocking.
This film actually, this movie made me want to see Oblivion, weirdly enough.
Oops, spoilers for Oblivion.
Which, no, I already know.
Okay, good.
Which nothing else in the world has done. Like, this is
even our light praise for it.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, that's okay. It's great to know that my opinion means nothing to you. No, I do agree.
You didn't know that by now? Or?
I've been deluding myself. I was going to say, I agree that my weird thing about this movie is, like, in Groundhog Day, Bill Murray, his character gets to continue living his life once he's, like, become a better person, right? And so he gets to carry those lessons, and every good thing that he did that day, every selfless, amazing thing, echoes on. So he's made those lives of those people better, he's made his own life better, la 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 la, it's great. In this movie, Tom Cruise becomes the hero, he finds courage and selflessness and blah blah blah, and then the timeline resets itself to that day, and he doesn't get the opportunity to do any of that, so he's not a hero. So at one point, it's kind of cool because it's like, oh, Tom Cruise is denying himself the obviously heroic role in these people's minds, at least in the mind of the movie. But on the other hand, it's like, so he's got all these great lessons that he's learned about heroism and self-sacrifice, but he doesn't actually have to apply any of them in order for his life to be fine and the aliens to be defeated. It is a little weird. However, I did say that I had a theory, and this is my theory.
Uh-oh.
My theory is this. So, this Omega creature, at some point they say it's better to think about the mimics, these aliens, as a single organism instead of, like, many individuals. So another hive mind alien species type of thing. So this Omega is the mother base, the controlling organism. It controls time. So whenever it senses that one of its little beloved alpha creatures has died, it brings time backwards. So the only thing I can think of that makes sense as for why, after being doused in its blood or caught in its plume of discharge, which is disgusting and I wish I hadn't said, is that the Omega creature keeps like 1 foot in the past and allows time to move forward a certain amount, and that by killing it, it loses that kind of toehold on the future that it has, and immediately reality whipcracks backwards to whatever its last foothold in the past was. Does that make sense?
That's bold.
Right? So, like, if you imagine time not as a flat circle, but as, like, a sheet of paper, the Omega is keeping the paper folded against itself so that it can easily, you know, in a split second, go back to the beginning. And when he kills it, that explosion that happens simultaneously in both times, and thus everything is brought back. Does that... I don't feel like I have to figure that out for the movie to be okay. I mean, that's obviously like a tacked-on happy ending. But it does make me feel a little bit better that you can say something like that and it makes sense. Ish.
Wow.
Anyone going to come at me for that?
No.
Nick?
No, I just don't care enough.
Okay, great. I did want to talk about one thing. I guess it's kind of a spoiler. I guess it doesn't really matter. So Emily Blunt's character, refreshingly unsentimental, obviously had a thing. She had her own Emily Blunt character when she was the Tom Cruise character in a thing that was, you know, that would be a good prequel. Just thinking about it, I would love to see Emily Blunt as the person who gets to unsympathetically just live the same day over and over again. But anyway, so was anyone else really hoping that they wouldn't kiss at the end? Not for like moral reasons, but because it was so much more interesting if they didn't. I mean, like, she had been such a strong female character that to get kind of, I'm not going to say reduced to a love interest, because she still very much had her own sense of agency in everything. But just that, I don't know, it would have been better if maybe they had done something like militarily, like saluted.
I feel like the timing was pretty good, just because it was like they were about to die. So
right.
It was just
and
kind
he
of
had
like
lost the ability.
Yeah, so it was just sort of like, yeah, it's like a, yeah, I'll kiss you because like we're probably going to die. Not like, oh, I'm suddenly like overwhelmed with feelings for you. But there was like, in terms of that romance plot, there was that one scene when they like had that long conversation in the car.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt like totally out of place, just because the movie like moves pretty quickly, so there's not a lot of time where it kind of stands still like that. And so that scene was kind of odd, and it introduced even more backstory for her that really didn't necessarily get...
Yeah, like that never... It never... Like, he learns her middle name, and I kept expecting that to come back.
Mm-hmm.
As like weird and mushmouth as that would be, if like his big romantic moment was to just say her goddamn full name.
Mm-hmm.
Like a parent scolding a child. But yeah, I mean, they're partnership.
It was a nice emotional moment. Come on.
It was, but I mean, but that should have come back later so that he could like prove to her that she's fallen for him before.
But isn't the point that it doesn't really come back?
I guess. Is it?
I don't know. Okay. I kind
that,
of my brain
Doug
got
Lehman?
Stuck trying to figure out exactly what the this movie's Wikipedia page has a very elaborate explanation of its like weekend by weekend box office gross.
That's weird.
If you go there, I feel like there's probably
who would take the time to put that on the Wikipedia page
more
for a movie about busting aliens.
Apparently, what I'm reading here, The film had premiere screenings in London, Paris, and New York City on May 20th, 2014. The cast and the crew mimicked the film's time loop premise by attending the premieres in a single day, traveling westward to attend them on a staggered schedule.
Oh my god, that's actually kind of cool, though.
Yeah, it's kind of neat.
I will say, however, going back to the female...
Going back to the actual film.
Going back to the actual film. I did like the fact that this is... I think this is one of the few action movies I can think of where the final goodbye kiss is initiated by the woman. So, like, if you're watching this film, like, there's there, their faces are close together. I'm like, oh, he's going to kiss her. But then it's her who, like, bridges the gap and grabs him. And then he has the formerly womanly role of, like, you know, bringing her hand to a man's face. Like, oh, you know, I'm giving into this. But that's, like, his part in this now. So I did like that. I did like the progressive gender politics of the movie.
Wow.
I was looking into it, man. Yeah, anything more to say? I mean, we could nitpick, but I don't want to. I had a lot of fun with this film, and I think it did some things very well, some things not so well, but on the whole, the balance sheet totals up in its favor. Mm. Any other thoughts before we move on to the week ahead?
You could do worse. You could see X-Men Days of Future Past, so you could do worse.
Okay.
Just in terms of what's in theaters right now. Yeah.
Yeah. You can see The Fault in Our Stars.
I haven't seen that picture.
I have read the book. It is miserable. I don't think I realized that it was a young adult book until I started reading it. And I was like, ugh, God.
Why didn't you stop?
I was reading it for a book club at my office.
Leave the book club.
So, well, I was like, it was my first day in the office. They're like, you want to join this book club? I was like, yeah. So I did it because I wanted to fit in. And then... It was funny because then the next time that we had like a choosing a book moment, I nominated Less Than Zero by Bret Easton Ellis.
Oh, wow.
And I won. So I think everyone had like tonal and emotional whiplash from moving from one to the other, which was awesome. Anyway, let's talk about the week ahead. June 10th, coming to Blu-ray and DVD. We have True Detective, the full series. We reviewed that on this show. I believe all of us loved it.
Yeah, you know, liked it very much.
Okay.
It was True Detective.
You know, it was a fan with some reservations, but yes, I would recommend it.
Excellent. Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit, which I saw, which is a very weird schizophrenic movie that doesn't really ever justify its own existence. We do have Nonstop with Liam Neeson, which was a thrill-a-minute joyride of wonder.
Nonstop.
We also talked about that on this podcast.
Good stuff.
Fucking Nonstop. But a very good movie. A good action thriller.
Honestly, still one of my favorite films of the year.
Really, honestly,
I really, really like that film a lot.
I fucking love it when that shows up in your top 10.
I bet it could be an honorable mention. It could be.
Top five, yeah.
Look, we all loved Flight, and Nonstop is like, you know, Flight's spiritual sister.
No, it's not. They're very different.
Alcoholic dude on a plane trying to save everyone? Come on. Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, the new series coming to Blu-ray. Blu-ray re-release of a couple of things. All That Heaven Allows, and L'Eclisse? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, I think that's pretty good.
Good enough?
Yeah, it sounds about right.
And then some other stuff. Tim's Vermeer, which I did not see. Yeah, so anyone thoughts on which of these is the best? Obviously Nick is riding high, on Nonstop still, and I'll agree with that, as well as True Detective. So those are my recommendations.
Yeah, I think the Criterion's All That Heaven Allows and L'Eclisse, I've actually only seen the latter, but I do love the latter. So hard to go wrong with those. We'll have pieces up on those. Up on the site soon, probably maybe by the time this is actually posted.
Yeah. Oh, that reminds me. I'm sorry for how long it took to get the last one up, but my computer crashed and corrupted everything.
Yeah, I think you tweeted something. What happened?
So if you follow me on Twitter. I was editing it. I was pretty far in, and I was saving religiously, as you do. And then I don't know what happened. My computer froze up. I had to shut it down and open it back up again. And then when I opened it, it said this Audacity file has been corrupted. And all data has been lost. So that sucked. So I had to go back to the raw audio file and completely re-edit it again. Only this time without the buffer of a couple of days on a weekend that I had free, so I had to do it every day after work, and I was falling asleep a lot. And you know what? Fuck you, computer. But we're back, and hopefully this one will be smoother. Yeah. Anyway. So those articles may be up by the time.
Yeah, this is up. And like I've seen both of those Criterion releases, so you could kind of prioritize my opinion over Nick's. Like, no offense, Nick. But I'm actually really into the cover for Tightrope. It's just Clint Eastwood and some Venetian blinds and a pair of handcuffs. That's like I want to see that movie immediately.
That is true. That's interesting.
He's just like looking. Like at a tightrope or something, you're just like, shit, man.
There's also apparently a movie coming out called Age of Tomorrow on Blu-ray and DVD.
Hmm. Well, there's also Devil's Knot.
Extinction has arrived, it says.
Anyway. This looks like it might be the Asylum.
The Asylum's version, that's what it seems like. Anyway, The Devil's Knot is also hitting, yes. Coming to theaters... 22 Jump Street, the sequel to 21 Jump Street. This directed by Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, who did 21 Jump Street and the Lego Movie, which I loved. In addition to that, we have How to Train Your Dragon 2. To what? I do not know. I'm looking forward to both of those. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed How to Train Your Dragon after a friend of mine finally forced me to watch it on DVD one weekend. And I kind of wish I'd seen it in theaters, so I'm looking forward to seeing this one in theaters. Obviously, I'm looking forward to 22 Jump Street, because I love Channing Tatum, and I'm a fan now of Chris Lord and Phil Lord and Chris Miller. We also have limited releases like Hellion, starring Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad, The Rover, which was one of my most anticipated films of the summer that we talked about a couple weeks ago, from the Blue Tongue Film Collective, Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson, and Scoot McNairy in that. And finally, The Signal, which I have heard about, like, obliquely, but I have no idea what it's actually about. So, gentlemen, which of these do you think is the best bet?
Looking forward to 22 Jump Street.
Looking forward to 22 Jump Street.
Oh, yeah. Looking forward to it. Big fan of the first. Have heard that the second lives up, which probably makes it better than 98% of comedy sequels.
Yeah.
So... I'm anticipating it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to say that everything kind of looks good this weekend. I don't think you can really go wrong. Obviously, I want to see The Rover. I don't think that when I see that, I'll be in the same mood as when I go and see 22 Jump Street or How to Train Your Dragon 2. But, you know, it'll be fun. It'll be a good time.
You just think it's like it has a different ambition than those other films?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I'm going to have to like adjust my expectations for both of them walking in. That's what I think. So let's wrap up by saying something that we've watched on our own this week, and then we can get out of here and go and get on with the rest of our lives until we have to inevitably come back next week, over and over again. Live, die, repeat. Danny King, what did you see this week that you would recommend to us?
Well, last night, as in Saturday evening, watched a film on Netflix Instant called Roger Dodger.
Okay.
You guys seen that one?
Not familiar with that one.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really good. From 2002, so it's like an early Jesse Eisenberg role. He plays like this kid entering college, who spends a night with his uncle, who's played by Campbell Scott, who's like a he just kind of shows him the ropes of his like philosophy, which is very entertaining. And the movie's like very dialogue driven, and the dialogue's great, and the actors are very good. I'm surprised I haven't really seen Campbell Scott in anything else, or maybe I'm just forgetting, but he's excellent. But the directing is also really good. There's like one conversation.
Scott was the dad in the new Spider-Man films.
Yeah, I know he's in those. I forgot, so... Can't say I remembered his performance. But there's one conversation that he has with Jesse Eisenberg, like on the streets of New York. And it's like a really long take and it's shot from like across the street. So their conversation is just constantly blocked by like moving cars and people. And it's a really phenomenal take. And then the opening scene, the close-ups were so tight and kind of strange that I thought the movie had been, I thought Netflix like fucked up the aspect ratio, but I checked and it was proper. So just some interesting directing as well, in addition to the great dialogue. So I would check that film out.
Yeah, definitely. I love Campbell Scott. He was great in The Spanish Prisoner.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll check that out.
Mammoth films, bitch. Yeah. That's where he's from, in my mind.
Yeah, he'd be good at a mammoth film, I imagine.
Yeah, him and Clark Gregg are like the perfect mammoth players. Anyway, Nick Newman, give us one of your own.
Briefly, I'm just going to say, in advance of what will certainly be a review, I saw Richard Linklater's Boyhood Tuesday. I'm just going to say that the movie sort of, you know, gave me a lot of feelings, and it was sort of a kind of a traumatic experience, I guess. We'll talk about it.
On a personal note, I would love to say how much I hate when people say gives me a lot of feelings or I had all the feels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that annoys the shit out of me. Right. But
I don't actually
anyway.
Say had all the feels, but yes. Made me feel many things.
There we go.
Most of them good.
Feelings.
But it was a lot to handle. So
I believe
definitely
it.
Recommend it. I don't think I ever want to see this movie again.
Too bad, so, bitch.
Well, no, I've already seen it, so.
Oh, you're not going to refresh yourself?
I think it'll stick in my memory very strongly.
Okay. Well, I can't wait to see that. That's good. Is that your choice then?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to say that I was looking on HBO for something to watch, and I watched About a Boy.
That is Hugh Grant.
It is Hugh Grant and Nicholas Hoult, who apparently I'm just like looking for people who were in X-Men First Class/X-Men Days of Future Past to watch movies about, because then at first it was like Filth and Wanted, and now it's Nicholas Hoult as a really weird looking little kid in About a Boy with Hugh Grant and Toni Collette, is that right? Anyway, this is a fun movie. Nicholas Hornby novel, the same guy who wrote High Fidelity. And it's about a man who begins pretending that he is a single father so he can meet women, and accidentally like meets this kid, and the kid starts hanging around with him because the kid's kind of a fucking nerd. It's an interesting film. I think it avoids the treacle that a lot of these kinds of films usually truck in. Yeah, it's a good time. It's on HBO. It's free. You should watch it if you haven't already. Have you two seen this?
Yeah, I saw it a couple years ago.
What'd you think?
No, never seen it.
You know, it was charming, I think.
Yeah, it's a charming film.
Yeah.
Nick,
it's about that boy.
I'll charm you.
All right, well, I mean, maybe it'll go well with Boyhood. I don't know.
Yeah, About a Boyhood.
I think it was probably released after Boyhood started shooting. Just crazy.
That is true, because Boyhood, they shot that for 12 years?
Yeah, it started in the summer of 2002.
This was released in 2002.
Well.
About a Boy.
About a Boy was actually shot...
About a Boyhood.
...with the same circumstances. Something anyway. People overlook.
Well, that's all for today. Next week, we'll be talking about something. Maybe 22 Jump Street, though we were just talking about how it's really difficult to... like critically analyze a comedy. You know, we could just come in and start quoting all of our favorite lines if we liked it that much. We'll maybe see the Rover. I don't know. Check us out on Twitter at Film Stage Show and get updates about the next show there. And that's it. That's all for today. So let's tell the people where you can be found on the internet in the meantime. Nick Newman.
TheFilmStage.com and Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
Danny King.
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And I can be found at TheFilmStage.com. Also, my personal site, DearFilm.net, and Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much once again for joining us. Tune in next week. Trailer. Do, 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 do.